Hi, welcome to the America Magazine podcast. I'm Kevin Clark, Chief Correspondent for America Media, America Magazine, americamagazine.org. Today I'm meeting with David Gardenstein Ross. David is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program. Obviously, David, we're here to talk about the horrible events last night in Nice. How is the world responding? How are the security people you're dealing with speaking about this latest atrocity?
Well, people are obviously in shock. This is another mass killing incident. You had over 80 people killed just by being mowed down by a truck. This spotlights another method that terrorists can use to attack. Terrorists have used ramming attacks before, primarily in Israel, though we've had a couple of them in the United States. But now it puts this kind of attack further up the radar. One of the questions that's being asked is, you know, what is the connection to organizations like the Islamic State? Was this a merely inspired attack? Is it connected to a network? That's something that investigators are looking at, as they should. Because in the past, when attacks have been written off right away as being lone wolf or unconnected to a network, often opportunities to break up future plots were missed. For example, the network that had carried out the Paris attacks back in November had carried out a number of attacks before that, which were written off as being lone wolf. And so the opportunity to figure out that network existed and to break it up was lost.
Uh-huh. And so we're not clear yet on this person, although from what I've seen on the internet, kind of a familiar profile of a loner with personal grievances is already taking shape. You're saying it's probably too early to make some kind of judgments in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, look, the loner or personal grievance, that doesn't really tell us much in terms of that question. It's a first cut at a profile, and you often, you know, first cuts are very surface level. But, you know, being a loner and having a grievance, you could either be, you know, highly interconnected with, say, pro-Islamic State networks, or you could be someone who's inspired by the organization, or you could have a different profile, a different sort of motivation altogether. I think that there's a tendency, especially in this 24/7 news cycle and social media, there's a desire to get things out there first, and narratives tend to solidify very quickly, but that's not how reality works. In reality, it often takes a while to figure out what's going on.
Yeah, and I'm trying to decide which is more frightening, the fact that this person or other people such as this terrorist acted individually or acted as part of a network. It's almost, is it a bizarre thing to say that it's almost comforting to think he's connected to a network? Because, you know, how do you defend against, you know, thousands of individuals who could similarly act on their unhappiness and grievances?
Right, right. I understand that view entirely, and I think that it's reasonable to say that one of them is more scary. It may well be that it's more scary if lone wolf attackers can do this much damage. Overall, the reason why it matters to analysts myself is not so much which one is more scary, but rather there are very real tactical implications and very real implications in terms of what the next step should be. There are different things to do when it's a lone wolf attack, different kind of prescriptions that would be called for than if a network is indeed in place.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's already people talking about France is going to strike hard against ISIS in Syria in response to this. How do you think that kind of reaction plays out over the long term? Is it really a situation where this war has to be taken from Nice to Syria in order to make a difference?
Well, look, I think part of the assumption underlying it is that this was an attack connected to the Islamic State. And having a caliphate in place, having this you know, quasi-state in place where attackers can plan and train for future attacks does make this organization more deadly. We could see that at play in the Paris and the Brussels attacks, where that network had a large number of operatives who had been in Syria, where they had trained and where they had planned, who then came over to Europe and wreaked absolute havoc in Europe. So that's the assumption that's underlying it. The ISIS's caliphate is an extraordinarily brutal thing. You know, they take sex slaves and they boast about it openly. They behead people. They are a genocidal organization. I think it's hard to disagree with France's decision to ramp up operations against ISIS. You know, even apart from this particular attack, they've carried out multiple attacks throughout the world. If you look at the end of Ramadan, they carried out attacks inspired or direct or connected to the network all over the place, all over the place. And so there are multiple reasons to want to see this very brutal extremist organization collapse much more quickly.
Do you think this latest incident might lead to the United States becoming even more involved in trying to stamp out ISIS in coordination with France?
It's possible. I mean, one thing I'll point out is that ISIS actually is in very clear decline right now. They've been losing territory quite rapidly and losing it on both sides of their caliphate, both on the Iraq side and also on the Syria side. So the United States has been going about this rather piecemeal, you're putting in a few hundred troops at a time. It has the appearance of being kind of a slow step-by-step escalation, or as one of my colleagues put it, a slow step-by-step mission creep. Anyway, it's possible that the U.S. will escalate. It certainly did after the Paris attacks, where prior to the massive attacks we saw in Paris, the view within the administration was clearly that time was on our side and that they could slow roll this process. And, you know, after the Paris attacks, that view swung around to that time was not on our side. And so there was more of a desire after the devastating Paris attacks to much more quickly topple ISIS from the perch that it enjoyed. We may see an escalation here against ISIS. It's not yet clear, especially because there's still information which isn't known based upon public reporting, like what is the connection to the network? You know, was this an ISIS attack? As of the time we're talking, there still isn't a claim of responsibility, though I will say it is overwhelmingly likely, based upon a number of factors, including recent attack patterns and the timing of this, that this is related to ISIS in some way.
Where do we go from here, closer to home? How is this kind of attack going to change policies in terms of the open societies that we inhabit here in the West, the United States and France and other parts of Europe that have proved vulnerable to attacks? Do you think you'll see higher security measures being taken? Do you think immigration policies are going to be looked at differently now?
There is going to be an increasing amount on the table because these kinds of attacks aren't going away. They are going to get worse before they get better. I'll tell you one thing that we should be thinking about is what I call crisis architecture. One thing that a lot of mass casualty attacks have in common is an architecture that either an internal architecture within a building or an outdoor architecture that makes it easier for attackers to kill a large number of people. Think of the Pulse nightclub shooting in Orlando. Mm-hmm. Think of the attack at the Bataclan in Paris. These were attacks where the club being attacked had a lot of people packed into a tight space. Not a lot of exits, not a lot of barriers to a shooter who was trying to move through the area. Put simply, there was architecture that was not designed for a crisis. Similarly, in this case, you have an attacker who literally was able to drive for 2 kilometers, mm-hmm. hitting people all the way. He didn't run into a spike strip. He didn't run into a barrier that was designed to slow down or stop a vehicle, which indicates, you know, architecture, outdoor architecture at this major event, which had been fingered by Al-Qaeda previously as a desirable target for a ramming attack, that the architecture wasn't designed to slow down an attacker who was trying to drive through and run people down. So, I think that sadly we're at a place where, not just for terrorism reasons, but for a wide variety of reasons, we need to think about crisis architecture, which can limit the amount of casualties.
So what Why didn't they think about that? You mentioned that terrorist groups had already cited that specific event, the Bastille Day celebrations, as a likely target. Temporarily closing down the streets for the crowds, why wouldn't French officials think about putting those kinds of barriers, that we see surface in New York a lot when events happen, those temporary concrete installations that stop traffic? How come that didn't happen in this case?
Impossible to answer without more information. All I would say is that that is an extraordinarily relevant question that needs to be asked. There's lots of things that we need to do, but right now we are at a sad point where these attacks are going to get worse before they get better. And so that's why it's important to think about how do we mitigate the impact and save lives, knowing that these things are going to continue.
Are you concerned that these events are going to lead to a blowback against the people in Syria and Iraq who are attempting to escape exactly this kind of terrorism?
Well, there's two different issues at play. One of them is attitudes toward or integration of migrants. The other one is migrant policy with respect to letting them in. Europe's policies in this regard have been extraordinarily irresponsible. In that, terrorists have moved through and been involved in mass casualty attacks like Paris using this irregular migration flow. That's how, for example, Abdelhamid Abaoud, who's one of the most wanted men in Europe, was able to move after a failed plot in Verviers in January of 2015, back into Syria. He was able to give media interviews from Syria and then move back into Europe, even though he was a highly wanted man. He told his colleagues that he used the migration flows, and it's documented that other attackers in the Paris attacks used the migration flows. Now, if you look at those flows, the European law enforcement and intelligence was not set up in a way to counter the threat that this posed in terms of potential for terrorists to enter that way, as indeed they have. Usually, by the time someone entering has been screened, they would have moved on and would be impossible for law enforcement to find. You often didn't have intelligence officers there, even when people who were there to guard the border saw something that they thought was out of place, they couldn't express it. In fact, in the case of two Iraqi attackers who took part in the Paris attacks, who moved through the Greek island of Leros, one of the law enforcement agents in Leros said that one of them in particular stood out for keeping to himself in a very unusual way. And he said, "I would have told an intelligence agent had one been present."
Wow.
So, look, one has to, of course, be compassionate to people who are moving out. Although I will point out, it's not as though their only choice is to come to Europe, right? There are refugee camps in the area. There are other places that take refugees much closer to them. So Europe is not the last choice that people have. Right? There are actually a number of other options that are right there within the region. So a lot of refugees are in Jordan, are in Turkey, are in Lebanon. But Europe has an obligation to look out for its citizens. This is a route that has been used to move terrorists into Europe, full stop. And so it is very important to try to safeguard European citizens. The rise of, far right or reactionary parties is, was so foreseeable, given the massive way in mul on multiple levels that this migration crisis has been utterly mishandled by European politicians.
Do you think that recently there's been a better response, or is it still sort of a lackluster, let the peripheral states deal with it kind of a approach?
It's hard to get a handle on where things are right now. The problems have been very clear. Whether there are some corrections being quietly made, I can't say definitively. From all the various sources I have and lines in, I think it is still a problem. I haven't seen that the problem has been remedied.
Okay, so there are some things we need to do to tighten security. Are there missteps we might take in overreacting to this situation?
Sure, there's always a danger of overreaction. Whenever one is trying to calibrate a policy in response to a crisis, there's, you know, always a danger of overreaction. There's always a danger of underreaction. You know, these are difficult policy steps.
Yeah, and it's a difficult balance to achieve between security and maintaining an open society.
Well, yeah, but on the specific issue we're talking about, which is migration flows, I think it's much less complex than people make it out to be. It poses a very clear security threat. And, you know, any society, one of its first obligations should be to take care of its own citizens. So there are ways you can deal with it by, for example, having, you know, refugees in more confined places until you can get a handle on whether they pose a security threat, or better integrating intelligence. But they absolutely, on that issue, do need to prioritize keeping European citizens safe. Those are their people. They need to protect their people.
Okay. Thank you so much. We've been speaking with David Gartenstein-Ross. Dr. Gartenstein-Ross is a senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies and an adjunct assistant professor at Georgetown University. We'll all be praying for Nice and the people of France this weekend. I feel like I say this almost every week now after one of these events, but there it is. It's our sad reality. Thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Gartenstein-Ross.
It was my pleasure.